We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor. Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app.
Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.
Who has a pre-existing condition or has any kind of a worry about getting support needs to worry that she's going to be an activist judge and go a justice and go in there and change the law. She's not, and we all know that. This is simply the tired, worn-out argument that is constantly made every time a Republican president nominates a candidate for the bench for the Supreme Court of the United States. And it's never been true, and it will not be true with Judge Barrett. So then the attack is, well, the Republicans don't care about people's health. They won't even try to get COVID relief out. And we're here in a hearing in the Judiciary Committee when we ought to be passing COVID relief legislation. And I've heard several of my colleagues basically say the Republicans are refusing to work on helping to address the COVID crisis. This coming from colleagues who just a month or so ago voted unanimously to filibuster a $500 to $600 billion COVID relief package in the Senate. A COVID relief package, I asked my staff to get me a quick summary of it, that put, as I indicated, somewhere between $500 and $600 billion into more small business loans, unemployment insurance, agriculture and farming assistance, postal service assistance, education assistance, both at the higher education levels and at K through 12, healthcare assistance for pandemic preparation for strategic stockpiles, for testing, for contact tracing, billions for vaccine and therapeutic and diagnostic development, and the list goes on. We were stopped from proceeding with this legislation by a filibuster of those who now accuse us of not wanting to try to do something. We stand ready if you'll simply let us go to the legislation and pass it. So now, Judge Barrett, let me talk about you. Judge, you have an exemplary academic record and legal credentials, and you are preeminently qualified to serve on our Supreme Court. Following your graduation from law school, you clerked for both the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia and the U.S. Supreme Court. At the Supreme Court, you clerked, as everyone knows, for none other than the late Justice Antonin Scalia. Upon receiving your nomination to the Supreme Court, Judge Barrett reflected on her clerkship for Justice Scalia, citing his incalculable influence on her life. She also stated that his judicial philosophy is hers too, and that a judge must apply the law as written. That's what we need in our next Supreme Court justice. Rather than the activist justice that you are being accused of being, judges are not policymakers, and they must be resolute in setting aside policy views that they may hold. And I know you know that. Should we not take Judge Barrett at her word? As a judge, Supreme Court or otherwise, she must be dedicated to interpreting the law as written with an unparalleled commitment to our Constitution. I've visited with her privately. I've reviewed her record. I have seen nothing that would indicate that she is not telling the truth when she says that is her view of how a judge should conduct herself. I've met with a number of Supreme Court nominees in my service in the Senate, and throughout I've continued to maintain an emphasis on following the law and upholding our Constitution, and that must be a central characteristic of the justices we select for this highly influential part of our government. Judges have a great responsibility to carefully exercise their authority within the limits of the law. Our court system has the responsibility to preserve our constitutional rights, ensure a limited government, and provide speedy and fair justice. Following her clerkships, Judge Barrett spent time in private practice before beginning her tenure as a professor. Her academic scholarship and lengthy analysis of issues facing the federal courts make her uniquely well qualified to serve on our nation's highest court. In particular, Judge Barrett's thoughtful exploration of the precedent and the doctrine of stare decisis demonstrates that she is both intellectual and deliberative in her understanding of the law. Moreover, it's evident that she understands the role of a fair and proper judge. In September 2017, Judge Amy Coney Barrett came before the Senate Judiciary Committee, this committee, after being nominated to the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. During that hearing, she repeatedly expressed her commitment to independent and unbiased decision-making. I was proud to support her confirmation to the Court of Appeals in both the committee and on the Senate floor. Judge Barrett's remarkable resume shows she is a pioneer in the legal field. She will be the fifth woman and the first mother of school-age children to serve on the Supreme Court. In many ways, she's the ideal candidate to fill this current vacancy. Mr. Chairman, I look forward to hearing more from the nominee about her experience and her judicial philosophy. The next few days will prove invaluable as we discuss with Judge Barrett at length the proper role of a judge in our legal system. I look forward to this hearing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I believe Senator Harris.
Can you hear me?
Yes, hello.
Hello?
We hear you.
This hearing has brought together more than 50 people
to
sit inside a room for hours. A closed door. Yes.
Just wait just one second. We don't see you.
Of course. You don't see me.
One, congratulations on being on the ticket. I hadn't told you that. There we go. All right.
Now, can you see me now?
Yeah, I can see you now, hear you loud and clear. The floor is yours.
Mr. Chairman, can you see me and hear me?
I see you. I hear you. The floor is yours.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This hearing has brought together more than 50 people to sit inside of a closed-door room for hours while our nation is facing a deadly airborne virus. This committee has ignored common-sense requests to keep people safe, including not requiring testing for all members, despite a coronavirus outbreak among senators of this very committee. By contrast, in response to this recent Senate outbreak, the leaders of Senate Republicans rightly postponed business on the Senate floor this week to protect the health and safety of senators and staff. Mr. Chairman, for the same reasons, this hearing should have been postponed. The decision to hold this hearing now is reckless and places facilities workers, janitorial staff, and congressional aides and Capitol Police at risk, not to mention that while tens of millions of Americans are struggling to pay their bills, the Senate should be prioritizing coronavirus relief and providing financial support to those families. The American people need to have help to make rent or their mortgage payment. We should provide financial assistance to those who have lost their job and help parents put food on the table. Small businesses need help, as do the cities, towns, and hospitals that this crisis has pushed to the brink. The House bill would help families and small businesses get through this crisis. But Senate Republicans have not lifted a finger for 150 days, which is how long that bill has been here in the Senate, to move the bill. Yet, this committee is determined to rush a Supreme Court confirmation hearing through in just 16 days. Senate Republicans have made it crystal clear that rushing a Supreme Court nomination is more important than helping and supporting the American people who are suffering from a deadly pandemic and a devastating economic crisis. Their priorities are not the American people's priorities. But for the moment, Senate Republicans hold a majority in the Senate and determine the schedule. So here we are. The Constitution of the United States entrusts the Senate with the solemn duty to carefully consider nominations for lifetime appointments to the United States Supreme Court. Yet the Senate majority is rushing this process and jamming President Trump's nominee through the Senate while people are actually voting, just 22 days before the end of the election. More than 9 million Americans have already voted, and millions more will vote while this illegitimate committee process is underway. A clear majority of Americans want whomever wins this election to fill this seat. And my Republican colleagues know that. Yet they are deliberately defying the will of the people in their attempt to roll back the rights and protections provided under the Affordable Care Act. And let's remember, in 2017, President Trump and congressional Republicans repeatedly tried to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. But remember, people from all walks of life spoke out and demanded Republicans stop trying to take away the American people's health care. Republicans finally realized that the Affordable Care Act is too popular to repeal in Congress. So now they are trying to bypass the will of the voters and have the Supreme Court do their dirty work. That's why President Trump promised to only nominate judges who will get rid of the Affordable Care Act. This administration, with the support of Senate Republicans, will be in front of the Supreme Court on November 10th to argue that the entire Affordable Care Act should be struck down. That's in 29 days that that'll happen. And that's a big reason why Senate Republicans are rushing this process. They are trying to get a justice onto the court in time to ensure they can strip away the protections of the Affordable Care Act. And if they succeed, it will result in millions of people losing access to health care at the worst possible time, in the middle of a pandemic. 23 million Americans could lose their health insurance altogether. If they succeed, they will eliminate protections for 135 million Americans with pre-existing conditions like diabetes and asthma, heart disease, or cancer, a list that now will include over 7 million Americans who have contracted COVID-19. Insurance companies could deny you coverage or could sell you a plan that won't pay a dime toward treating anything related to your pre-existing condition. If the Affordable Care Act is struck down, you will have to once again pay for things like mammograms and cancer screenings and birth control. Seniors will pay more for prescription drugs, and young adults will be kicked off of their parents' plans. And these are not abstract issues. We need to be clear about how overturning the Affordable Care Act will impact the people we all represent. For example, Micah, who is 11 years old, and she lives in Southern California. So Micah enjoys being a Girl Scout and ice skating and reading and eating pasta and baking. Her mother says the only reason Micah is able to live her life as she does now is because the Affordable Care Act guarantees that her health insurance cannot deny her coverage or limit her care because it's too expensive. You see, Micah has a congenital heart defect. She goes to multiple specialists throughout the year and gets an MRI with anesthesia every 6 months. At just 11 months old, Micah's family had already hit $50,000 in medical expenses, and her biannual MRI cost were $15,000 a session. And so, correction, she by 11 months old, her family had hit $500,000 in medical expenses. If Republicans succeed in striking down the Affordable Care Act, insurance companies will be able to deny coverage for children with serious conditions. Children like Micah. And parents, well, they'll be on their own. No one should face financial ruin to get their child or their spouse or their parent the care they need. And no family should be kept from seeing a doctor or getting treatment because an insurance company says that the treatment is too expensive. In America, access to health care should not be determined based on how much money you have. Healthcare and access to healthcare should be a right. MICA and millions of others who are protected by the Affordable Care Act know this is fundamentally what is at stake with this Supreme Court nomination. And of course, there's more at stake. Throughout our history, Americans have brought cases to the United States Supreme Court in our ongoing fight for civil rights, human rights, and equal justice. Decisions like Brown versus Board of Education, which opened up educational opportunities for Black boys and girls. Roe versus Wade, which recognized a woman's right to control her own body. Loving v. Virginia and Obergefell v. Hodges, which recognized that love is love and that marriage equality is the law of the land. The United States Supreme Court is often the last refuge for equal justice when our constitutional rights are being violated. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg devoted her life to fight for equal justice, and she defended the Constitution. She advocated for human rights and equality. She stood up for the rights of women. She protected workers. She fought for the rights of consumers against big corporations. She supported LGBTQ rights, and she did so much more. But now, her legacy and the rights she fought so hard to protect are in jeopardy. By replacing Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg with someone who will undo her legacy, President Trump is attempting to roll back Americans' rights for decades to come. Every American must understand that with this nomination, equal justice under law is at stake. Our voting rights are at stake. Workers' rights are at stake. Consumer rights are at stake. The right to a safe and legal abortion is at stake. And holding corporations accountable is at stake. And again, there's so much more. So, Mr. Chairman, I do believe this hearing is a clear attempt to jam through a Supreme Court nominee who will take health care away from millions of people during a deadly pandemic that has already killed more than 214,000 Americans. I believe we must listen to our constituents and protect their access to health care and wait to confirm a new Supreme Court justice until after Americans decide who they want in the White House. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Harris. Senator Kennedy.
You have a beautiful family, Judge. We claim you in Louisiana. We're proud of the fact in Louisiana that you were born in Metairie, a suburb of New Orleans. We're proud of the fact that you got a solid education at St. Mary's Dominican High School. Come back and visit us. I know your mom and dad still live there, and we're very proud of you and your career. This is a solemn occasion, as it should be. I can't think of another position, at least not a position that is for life, not a position in which the occupant is not elected by the people, that is more powerful, at least not in the Western world, than an associate justice of the Supreme Court. And this process is not supposed to be the Big Rock Candy Mountain. Our job is to advise and consent. And that's a one way of saying that we're supposed to make sure that the president hasn't, whatever president makes the nomination, hasn't made a mistake. And we all, as you can see, take that job seriously, as you can see, and we know you respect that. That's why I think over the next several days, it's appropriate for us to talk about your intellect. which is obvious, by the way, and your temperament, your character, and your judicial philosophy. And I hope we can talk about something else. That's the role of the federal judiciary in American life. Now, look, Judge, I'm not naive. I understand this thing can turn sour real fast. We all watched the hearings for Justice Kavanaugh. It was a freak show. It looked like the cantina bar scene out of Star Wars. And I know, for someone unaccustomed to it, that it hurts to be called a racist. I think it's one of the worst things you can call an American. I know that it hurts to be called a white colonialist. And I know it must hurt for someone of deep Christian faith like yourself to be called a religious bigot. And to have it implied that because you are a devout Christian, that you're somehow unfit for public service. Before it's over with, they may call you Rosemary's baby, for all I know. I hope not. And I know, as we've seen this morning, I know you think it's unfair. It is unfair for my colleagues to suggest, some overtly, some more indirectly, that if you're put on the United States Supreme Court, you will be on a mission from God to deny health care coverage for pre-existing conditions for every American. I know that seems preposterous to you, and it seems that way because it is. Take comfort in the fact that the American people, some of my colleagues disagree with the statement. They believe in government. I believe in people. The American people are not morons. They can see drivel when they see it, and they can appreciate it when they see it for being what it is. Now, let me turn to what I hope quickly we can talk about today. Americans love democracy. We'll even fight for it, and we have. And that's a wonderful thing. It's an important thing in today's world as this world becomes more authoritarian. And our founders, but we don't have a pure democracy. As a columnist I read this morning said, we don't, when we have to decide a complex issue dealing with social norms or economic issues, we don't all put on a toga and go down to the forum and vote. We have elected representatives. Those are members of Congress, and it is our elected representatives' job to decide social and economic policy. And if we don't like what they do, they're accountable. We vote them out. But in the last 50 years, certainly in the last 25, the United States Congress, either voluntarily or involuntarily, has ceded a lot of its power to the executive branch and to the federal judiciary. When I say the executive branch, I'm not necessarily talking about the president. I'm talking about the administrative state, the bureaucracy, as some call it. It's this giant rogue beast that enjoys power now that only kings once enjoyed. Members of the administrative state write their own laws. They interpret their own laws. They litigate their own laws in their own courts before judges that they appoint. And Congress has allowed that to happen. I think Congress has also abdicated a lot of power to the federal judiciary. I do. And I'm not saying that federal judges don't make law. Of course they make law. They make law in the context of a specific case. It's called judicial precedent. But our founders intended federal judges to exercise judicial restraint and to understand the special role, scope, and mission of the federal judiciary vis-a-vis the United States Congress. I don't think our founders intended judges to be politicians in robes. I think our founders intended judges, federal judges, to tell us what the law is, not what the law ought to be. I think our founders intended, as the Chief Justice put it, I think our founders intended federal judges to call balls and strikes. I don't think our founders intended for federal judges to be able to redraw the strike zone. I don't think our founders intended for judges to be politicians in robes. Politicians, you don't want the United States Supreme Court to turn into this. Trust me. Politicians get to vote their preferences under our democracy. Judges do not. Judges do not. And finally, unlike some of my colleagues, I don't think our founders intended the United States Supreme Court to become a mini Congress. I don't think our founders intended members of the United States Supreme Court to try to write our statutes or the United States Constitution every other Thursday because they to prosecute a social or an economic agenda that they can't get by the voters. And that goes on in America every day. We've reached the point where one single solitary federal judge in a limited venue can enjoin a federal statute or an executive order of the President of the United States for the entire country. And our founders never intended that. I want to close with two very short quotations. The first, stated much more eloquently than I can, is Justice Curtis in 1857. You probably read it. He was dissenting in the Dred Scott case. This is what Judge Curtis said. When a strict interpretation of the Constitution, according to the fixed rules which govern the interpretation of laws, is abandoned, and the theoretical opinions of individuals are allowed to control its meaning, we have no longer a Constitution. We're under the government of individual men, who for the time being have power to declare what their constitution is according to their own views of what it ought to mean. And finally, a more contemporary statement from a gentleman that you're very familiar with, Justice Scalia. He said it in real world terms. This is what he said. The American people love democracy, and the American people are not fools. The American people know their value judgments are quite as good as those taught in any law school. Maybe better. Value judgments, after all, should be voted on, not dictated. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Kennedy. Senator Blackburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Judge Barrett, congratulations to you and to your family. I'm delighted to see that they are back in the room. And I'm thrilled that they are here with us today. You know, we have had 164 American citizens come before this committee for nomination to the Supreme Court. And today is the fifth time that we have had a female judge come before us. So we welcome you. And I will say this. Unfortunately, it's neither rare nor remarkable to see the kind of performances my Democratic colleagues have put on today. What they're trying to do is to convince the American people that they should be terrified of Judge Amy Coney Barrett. If you listen closely to their full statements, it betrays their true intent. If you go back through the transcript, you're going to find not a coherent legal counterargument, but a panicked stump speech on behalf of their controversial platform. Rather than reviewing your judicial philosophies, They're instead choosing to project their own desires and their fears onto the American people. It sounds as if they are trying to create a panic. They decided to drum up indignation over the fact that you dared to present a counter-argument against the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. Apparently, a difference of opinion between two brilliant jurists who often disagree is just too much for them. The rhetoric is unsettling, but after listening to them, I worry more about its underpinnings, because my colleagues' remarks have displayed their troubling belief that nothing but an activist judiciary will do for them. Given your track record, you'd think that my colleagues would jump at the opportunity to support a successful female legal superstar who is highly regarded by both her Democratic and Republican colleagues and who is a working mom. But as today's increasingly paternalistic and frankly disrespectful arguments have shown, if they had their way, only certain kinds of women would be allowed into this hearing room. On that note, not so long ago, in another hearing, they scrutinized your commitment to your Catholic faith and tried to use that as a way to question your competency and your professionalism. They know that that is unconstitutional. The Constitution forbids it. You are a brilliant jurist and a constitutional law expert. You will be an intellectual powerhouse on the Supreme Court, and you will steer the panel's focus toward textualism and originalism as rightful guiding philosophies. I love Justice Scalia's definition of textualism. Textualism, in its present form, begins and ends with what the text says and fairly implies. He goes on to defend textualism and explains that this method can lead to both conservative and liberal outcomes. Similarly, originalism doesn't always lead a jurist down the path they'd most like to follow. This method of interpretation holds that the meaning of a legal document, such as the Constitution, remains fixed, even when applied over time to new questions. Staying true to these guidelines requires more study and patience than other methods that allow judges to reinvent the law or be activists when things get tricky. Since taking the bench, I appreciate that you have written over 100 opinions and have participated in over 900 appeals where you have applied this complex reasoning. Thank you for that. We know that you are a prolific scholar and author of over a dozen articles on the courts and the Constitution. The ABA has rated you as well qualified to serve as a Supreme Court justice. I appreciate that many times you've probably done this with the child in your arms, on your hip, or somewhere in tow, maybe waiting for a ball game to begin. You have done all of this as you have been a friend, a mentor, a wife, and a mom. These are impressive qualifications by any standard. So it is no surprise that you are fielding attacks from other angles. Many of my colleagues have wasted a lot of their time complaining that the process, in an effort to delay and obstruct a legitimate, constitutionally sound confirmation hearing. Let's not forget, it was the Democrats who took an axe to process in 2018 when they dropped last-minute, unsubstantiated sexual assault allegations against Justice Kavanaugh. We still don't have the full story about their level and manner of coordination with activists and mainstream media outlets, but what we do know is that they turned that confirmation into a circus, And on that note, it is hard to take seriously their complaints about moving too quickly. We've heard about the timeline for Justice O'Connor, 33 days, Justice Ginsburg, 43 days. And just a word on Justice Ginsburg, whose seat we are filling. She was indeed a role model for many because she fought to open more doors for women in the law and beyond, and I sincerely hope that I am as effective an advocate in the Senate as she was on the court. We know from studying American history that women have had to always fight for a seat at the table. This goes back to Abigail Adams, who urged her husband John to please remember the ladies in their fight for independence. And we know it took 150 years for women to get that right to vote, but the Constitution allowed for that amendment process. Unfortunately, what we see today is that radical activists would like nothing more than to take a hatchet to process. Their favorite play is confronting the American people with the supposed illegitimacy of the Constitution. They argue that our founders' flaws, and yes, they were flawed. They're all humans are. That the flaws invalidate the principles that bind this country together. This betrays a dangerously naive understanding of the point and purpose of our founding legal document. The timeless principles contained in that document were written to protect individual rights absolutely. These principles, of course, include the separation of powers and federalism in our government, a system of checks and balances that prevents encroachment by one branch or another. If Congress acts beyond the scope of its legislative authority or the president grows too power hungry, the judiciary has the authority to rein that branch back in. And if the vast bureaucracy dares to overregulate, states and their citizens have the right to stand up and challenge that overreach as being beyond the scope of federal power. Together, the separation of powers and federalism have protected our republic from falling into the hands of tyrants. But keep in mind that the founders despised the tyranny of British rule just as much as they despised the whims of the mob. Flash forward to today, when American exceptionalism is under bitter attack from yet another mob. While most Americans take pride in our heritage, a vocal minority finds fault at every turn. They demand to know, can we still call the Constitution a relevant, valid source of law, even if no women or people of color participated in the drafting? Are the principles in that document still capable of curbing abuses of power and safeguarding freedom? Can we have faith that the future of democracy remains strong despite a summer of looting and violence in the streets? The answer to each is yes. And over the next few days, I expect that you, Judge Barrett, will explain why. So many families are watching today, and we're all going to be listening. Thank you for appearing before us. We look forward to your answers.
So that was Senator Marsha Blackburn wrapping up the 22 members of the House or the Senate, Judiciary Committee, providing those opening statements, and Amy Coney Barrett's opening statement will be coming up next. We're going to break for just a quick minute. Go grab your snacks and your lunch and come right back with us. We are covering this live here on 97.1 during the Andy Fry Show today, tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday. We're going to do this together, and you can watch us and chat with us online and our live stream at the Annie Fry Show Facebook page, the Annie Fry YouTube page, and you can stream at radio.com. We're going to be back in just a minute with more live Amy Coney Barrett SCOTUS confirmation hearing. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. Thank you for joining us today. Quite a little bit of an extended Annie Fry Show as we are involved in a little special coverage here of the Amy Coney Barrett confirmation hearing. Now, they have gone through the 22 senators that have given their testimony just to, let's see here, I'll list off who you might have missed in case you want to go back and check them out. The chair of the Judiciary Committee is Lindsey Graham. the ranking member on the Democrat side is Dianne Feinstein. We've heard Chuck Grassley, Patrick Leahy, John Cornyn, Dick Durbin. That was a treat. Mike Lee, Sheldon Whitehouse, Ted Cruz, Amy Klobuchar, Ben Sasse, Chris Coons, Josh Hawley, Richard Blumenthal, Tom Tillis, Mazie Hirono, Joni Ernst, Cory Booker, Mike Crapo, Kamala Harris, John Kennedy, and Marsha Blackburn. So they have all given their opening statements, and now there are, I think they're going to have three other people speaking who are basically character witnesses for Amy Coney Barrett. At this point, after hearing everything that was discussed so far, do you think that the character of Amy Coney Barrett has anything to do with this hearing? Because the Democrats have had the opportunity to criticize her character. They took a lot of there was a lot of discussion about the Affordable Care Act. There was not much discussion about whether Amy Coney Barrett's fit for this job.
They're not talking to her or about her at all. I mean, they've barely mentioned her name or addressed her. It's like, why is she even there? Why let her take the day off? Let them do their opening statements, then she can come in tomorrow. CNN's not even airing this, so it's very strange that for all the posturing ahead of this, the Democrat side of this must think that this is going to be a net loss for them because they're almost trying to hide it more
than
anything.
To bury it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So during this back and forth and the hearing testimony that we've heard, the opening statements that we've heard from a lot of the Democrats, the key issue here, for sure, a thread that you could put through every single Democrat that spoke regarding Amy Coney Barrett's nomination confirmation process. We're hearing a lot of people saying that it's being rushed, that it's being rammed through. They keep talking about the Affordable Care Act. So I thought, let's go back to the ACA, shall we? Because the way that the Democrats are talking here, it's going to cost you $1 billion from now on if you ever want to get a mammogram. You're going to have to pay for everything. It says if insurance, health insurance as we know it, will cease to exist and everybody is going to have to pay for everything. Pregnancy will be considered a pre-existing condition and you won't be covered. Just, you know, all of the really, really scary, frightening stuff about what we've heard previously about health insurance. So I went and I looked. I thought, wow, if this is so good, let's go back to see who supported this whole plan in the first place. And I gotta tell you what, folks, it's shocking to me, even though I know this, like, intellectually, I think I knew this ahead of time. When the Senate passed the Affordable Care Act, it passed 60 to 39. Did you know that? It passed that overwhelmingly, 60 to 39. Did you also know that every one of those 60 votes was a Democrat? Every single one. Not one Democrat voted against it. 39 Republicans in the Senate at the time voted against it. And one Republican, Senator Bunning out of Kentucky, did not vote at all. It really frustrates me to go back and look at these senators, many of whom on this panel were in this vote. The way they discussed the Affordable Care Act, as if it's some sort of agreed upon big group hug for the United States of America. Like this is something that has been such a gift to the country that they accomplished. It was a completely partisan process to begin with. And if you remember, what was her name? Nancy Pelosi. You remember what she said when they passed it in the House? They said you had to pass the damn thing before they could read to see what's in it. Are you kidding me right now with this? This is what we're talking about. The Democrats are contorting themselves into trying to make the Republicans look like they're doing some enormously partisan act right now to take away your health care. Rawr, scary. That's what they're trying to do right now. They're trying to spook you. They're trying to frighten you. They're trying to scare you into buying what they're trying to spoon feed, shove into your mouth and into your throat. That's what they're trying to do again. And it's the same thing. Like it's like Stockholm syndrome. You've been a captive to this for so long that if you're just listening to what these Democrats try to frighten you into believing, that this enormous gift that they have given to you in the Affordable Care Act that the Republicans want to take it away. Well, the Republicans never wanted you to have it in the first place because it's a piece of crap. It's not the answer to a broken healthcare system in our country. And saying that is an acknowledgement that also the healthcare system as we knew it before the Affordable Care Act passed was not perfect, and it needed improvement. But why the heck are we always talking about how to pay for these expensive things? Why are we not talking about why they cost so damn much all the time? It's the same thing with education. College education is obnoxiously expensive, and all Democrats want to do is write fat checks with your paycheck, with your tax dollars. They want to make everything free, but nobody ever wants to make it more affordable. And then they have the nerve to name this the Affordable Care Act. Affordable for who? Has your insurance cost gone down? Has your deductible gone down? Has your copay gone down? Has your premium gone down? Of course it hasn't. Did you like your doctor? Did you get to keep your doctor? Of course you didn't. They sell you lies, and then they stroke your head and act as if what you're dealing with right now is so terrible, and they're the ones who are going to solve it. They're the ones who poison the food to begin with. 60 Democrats voted in favor of this in this Senate. 60 Democrats voted in favor of this. 39 Republicans said no, and they act as if it's a surprise that the Republicans don't want to keep it. Don't pee on my leg and tell me it's raining. We are not as stupid as you need us to be. We're going to take a quick break. We think Amy Coney Barrett's going to be talking here. Oh, yep, getting sworn in now. You're not going to miss a single bit of that. We're going to bring you straight to it. When we come back, and I'm going to take a break. Ryan, everything good over there? Doing all right?
Yeah, I'm.
High five?
It's fun. High five.
High five.
We're good.
Katie, high five?
Oh, doing great. High five.
Stick around. Stream us on the Annie Fry YouTube page. Stream us on the Annie Fry Show Facebook page. And you weigh in. We are reading every single one of these comments. And we'll be back with Amy Coney Barrett's statement in just a minute.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.